Good morning, everyone. Thank you for being here for this session. I know there's a bunch of other sessions going on all over the place, and there's a lot of choices, so I wanted to thank you for taking the time to come and listen to all of us. So getting on with my presentation, I'm going to talk about the evaluation of our program, Paso a Paso, Building Healthy Families in Hispanic High School-Aged Adolescents. As usual, here's my disclosure. I have no financial relationships to disclose, unfortunately. Well, the objectives of this presentation, I'm going to be talking about the prevalent sexual knowledge, attitudes, and behaviors of high school-aged youth in border communities. Also talking about the changes in knowledge, attitudes, and behaviors of high school adolescents going through a sexual health education program. And we'll also evaluate the retention of these changes through follow-up over 12 months. A little bit of background about the program and the communities that we're in. We're working with predominantly Hispanic communities along the border, and I guess most of you would know that minority communities are disproportionately affected by sexual health problems. So they have higher rates of sexually transmitted infections, teen pregnancies. And previous research on Hispanic youth has shown that they have unique cultural beliefs. For example, one article that I recently looked at talked about the importance that they placed on virginity versus the importance that they placed on sexual satisfaction and how it affected their partner number and condom use. So they do have certain unique cultural beliefs that influence their behaviors. And also parent involvement generally is protective. It's also been seen in Hispanic communities that involving parents in sexual health of adolescents is a protective factor. And actually, that's what I was talking about in the other room just a little while back. So we are into predominantly Hispanic border communities that that have high teen pregnancy rates, and most of the population lives below the poverty line. So there's a lot of stuff going on here. And just as an example, let me show you the birth rates that were in the country, in the state, and in our program areas for 15 to 19 year olds when we started the program. At that time, the state birth rate for the state of Texas was higher than the national birth rate. For El Paso County, the county that we're in, it was even higher than the state birth rate. And for San Elizario and Fabens school districts, the two districts that we're in, the teen birth rate was double that of the county birth rate, which was higher than the state birth rate. And 70% of the county births were to teen mothers, so there was a definite need for some kind of program to take care of the situation. The sexually transmitted infection rates by area, just looking at the gonorrhea and chlamydia rates, El Paso County had a higher birth rate, higher gonorrhea rate than the border, but it was still lower than Texas, the state rate. For chlamydia, El Paso had a higher rate than the border as well as the state rate. Now, a little bit of this could be because of lack of awareness, lack of detection. So when people don't know about sexually transmitted infections, especially asymptomatic infections like gonorrhea and chlamydia, it's really hard for those infections to get caught and treated. So we figured there was a little bit of that going on in this area. So we set up a program in two school districts, or two towns in El Paso County, Fabens and San Elizario, with a total population of about 20,000 residents. It's a predominantly Hispanic population, and a large proportion of this population is less than 18 years old. The purpose of the program was to promote risk avoidance among youth aged 12 to 18 years in the two independent school districts in El Paso County. We provided community-based sexual health education and also implemented community-wide activities to support the risk avoidance education that we were providing to adolescents, as well as the parent education that we were providing to adults in the program. And that's a picture of one of our community events. We start off the school year with a fiesta or a kickoff event where which have been hugely successful in the past few years. So parents, students, school administrators, staff, they're all there to start off the school year and the program. During this program, we provide education in, for the high school component, education is provided to 10th to 12th graders in the two school districts. It's age-appropriate information, so the information is added on in each year. And it's a 6 to 10 session sexual health curriculum for these grades. And information is provided to the students on anatomy and reproduction, sexually transmitted infections in teen pregnancy, abstinence and contraception, and also healthy and unhealthy relationships. Because when we were talking to the communities, one of the things that came up again and again was that these kids really need to know about relationship skills or relationships in general. We also ensured age and cultural appropriateness in the program. So we did, what we did was that we did focus groups of the target population before we set up the program. We talked to the boys and girls separately and talked about their life goals, talked about their peer norms and attitudes, sexual activity and reasons for having sex, and also other risk behaviors like alcohol and drug use. We also asked them about, you know, what were their parental expectations, what kind of communication was going on between parents and kids about sex. And we used all this information to tailor our program messages and evaluation so that, you know, we could hit the things that were influencing behaviors in these communities. For example, when we talked to the high school boys, they told us that guys care more about the girl than the girl cares about the boy being a virgin. So, and actually both our boys and girls told us that virginity was an important concept when it came to the girls, but the boys thought it wasn't important for them, which was a cultural belief. On the other hand, the girls, by this time being in high school, were saying, well, if the boys can do it, so can we. I could go to a party tonight and hook up. It's easy to get drinks, it's easy to get drugs, it's easy to get some if I want some. So just looking at these attitudes and these beliefs that were coming from our from the students, you know, we took some of that information to tailor our program. We did have to go through school district, community, and IRB approvals, of course. We did get opt-in parental consents and student assents, and to evaluate the program, we conduct pre, post, and follow-up surveys. The follow-up survey is actually the pre-survey for the next year, so we're following the same group of students over years and looking at their data across the years. We use unique ID codes for anonymity and for matching. It's one of the ways to encourage kids to answer honestly by telling them, hey, you're not going to put your name anywhere on the survey. This is an anonymous code. Nobody knows what you've said, what answers you've provided, especially not your teachers and parents. So in these surveys, we assess the knowledge, beliefs, and attitudes that these kids have about sex. We also assess their perceived peer norms, attitudes, and behaviors, parental connectedness and communication, and sexual and other risk behaviors like smoking and drinking. The results of these surveys, and I'm talking about pre, post, and follow-up data that we collected in 2007-08. So 621 students answered pre, post surveys, and 327 of these also provided us with follow-up data. And the difference that you see here is not because of students falling out of the program, it's because of the 12th graders that graduated, and we continue to follow the 10th and 11th graders at the follow-up survey time as well. The respondents were predominantly Hispanic, 94% Hispanic. About half of them were males, half females. The age range was 14 to 19 years. And the risk behaviors that they were telling us about, 30% said that they had ever smoked a cigarette, 37% had alcohol in the last 30 days, and 40% used drugs in the last 30 days. These are really high rates of alcohol and drug use, but that's also something that we had found out in our focus groups, that for getting alcohol and drugs for these kids, it was really, really easy. It was easier to get drugs than to get alcohol because they did not need an ID. So their sexual behaviors, 43% of these kids had had vaginal sex, and the median age of starting to have sex was 15 years. 11% had anal sex, and 20% had two or more partners in the last 30 days. We did not ask about oral sex because, again, our focus groups had told us that vaginal sex happens first, and then kids go on to experiment with oral and anal sex. So this is something that we did not expect, and it was definitely something different from what, you know, kids in the other areas of the country seem to be doing as far as sexual behaviors are concerned. Also, 44% of these kids had used drugs or alcohol before sex in the last 30 days. And when they were asked about their perceived peer behaviors and norms, 92% said that most teens their age were having sex. However, only 40% said that most or all of their close friends have had sex. So there was this huge difference in what they thought was going on around them and what was actually going on around them. So, you know, about 40% said that most or all of their close friends have had sex, and about 43% had vaginal sex, which is closer. But they thought that 90% of the kids, or most of them thought most kids their age were having sex. So it was really important to look at these differences and also bring these differences to the notice of our students. So we did run a factor analysis on our evaluation instrument, and we came up with three scales. There was a knowledge scale with six items that asked about items such as, you know, you can look at a person and know whether they have a sexually transmitted infection. It asked about stuff like, can HIV be transmitted by mosquito bites? Does having a sexually transmitted infection raise your risk of HIV? Also, are condoms 100% effective in preventing sexually transmitted infections like chlamydia and HIV? There was an abstinence attitude scale with seven items, and some of these items included stuff like asking students whether they agreed or disagreed with, whether it was okay to go to a party and have sex with someone they just met, whether it was okay to have sex with their boyfriend or girlfriend, whether they thought that kids their age should wait before they had sex, and also whether they thought kids their age should wait until marriage to have sex. So some of the examples. We also asked about parental connectedness, and some of the items that we included were how often they were having dinner with their parents every week, whether they had talked to their mother or father about sexual health topics and other topics, whether their parents had talked about body changes, peer pressure, sexually transmitted infections, pregnancy, and contraception. And we also asked about monitoring, whether their parents knew who their friends were, where they were spending their time and money. So in our results, we did see an increase in, these are the scores for the knowledge scale. So the maximum score for this was 6. So we did see an increase in knowledge scores from 3.5 to 4.5 from pre-test to post-test. And there was a slight dip between post-test and follow-up. Now the post-test and follow-up the follow-up time was the beginning of the next school year, so there was summer vacation in between, and we're thinking these kids lost some of that information over this time. But it was interesting for us to see that they did retain most of the information that they had received in the classes. Also, here are the results from the paired samples test. These differences were significant. About their abstinence attitudes, this was a Likert scale with four categories, strongly agree to strongly disagree. So the maximum score on this one was 28, and we did see an increase in the abstinence attitudes from 13.8 to 17.6 between pre and post, and again there was a dip from post to follow-up. But even after the dip, there was the students still retained some of those attitudes in spite of that little decrease between post and follow-up. And again, all of these differences were significant. So there was a significant change in their attitudes between pre and post, and between post and follow-up, and between pre and follow-up surveys. Interestingly, when we asked about parent connectedness, there was a little bit of an increase from pre to post, and also post to follow-up. So there was no dip in this one, and some of it could be because in that year, when we started classes with the students, we actually did the parent, we do have a parent component to the program, so we did the parent classes after the school year was over during the summer when, you know, we thought parents would have time to attend these classes, so which is probably why there was a little bit, you know, there was an increase from post to follow-up time. However, after that, we have started doing parent classes alongside the high school classes, just because the parents and the students need to be getting the same information at the same time so they can talk about it, rather than the students getting some information, forgetting about it, and then the parents getting it at a different time and then talking about it with their kids. And even though this difference for the parent connectedness was significant, it is a very small difference. It's probably not practically significant, so I'm not not going to go into too much detail with that. We did run logistic regression to see what the predictors of sexual activity were for our high school kids. And as expected, age was a predictor. So as they get older, they're more likely to have sex. No big surprise there. If they had never smoked a cigarette, it was actually a protective factor with the odds ratio of 0.5. If they had drinks in the last 30 days, we'd categorize this variable. So if they had four or more drinks in the last 30 days, they were more likely to be sexually active. Same with drugs. If they've never used drugs, it's a protective factor. If they had dinner at least 5 times a week with their parents, again, it was protective when it came to their sexual behaviors, their sexual activity. If they knew that their parents did not approve of them having sex, even if they were careful about avoiding pregnancy, just knowing those expectations was also pretty protective. And that's supported by some of the previous research where, you know, maternal disapproval can help delay sexual debut in adolescent girls. Again, having a higher score on the abstinence attitude scale was protective. And one of the biggest odds ratios that we got was how many on the item, how many of their close friends have had vaginal sex. So there was definitely a lot of peer influence going on, influencing sexual activity in these high school kids. So kids who had close friends, or where most or all of their close friends had had vaginal sex, they were 2.2 times as likely to become sexually active than kids who had a fewer number of friends who were sexually active. So looking at all these factors, it definitely showed that, you know, engaging in other risk behaviors was one of the factors that would influence a kid into becoming sexually active. Parental connectedness was protective. Having a favorable abstinence attitude was protective. And having peers who were not sexually active was protective when it came to youth sexual activity. And I just heard something this morning about kids who text a lot or use the social media a lot. They seem to be engaging in risk behaviors a lot more than other kids, whether it's smoking, drinking, drugs, or sex. So that was interesting. So yeah, just in conclusion, you know, parents definitely need to be involved in their youth, in their kids' sexual health. They need to keep telling, talking about their expectations. Abstinence attitudes are favorable towards discouraging sexual activity in youth, in high school age youth. Friends can be the devils sometimes. So so it's necessary to have a good peer group that can influence your attitudes and behaviors in the right direction. And of course, other risk behaviors like drinking, smoking, drugs, need to stay away from them. So basically, for public health program planning, these data show that sexual health information should focus on risk avoidance. It should focus on encouraging abstinence attitudes and attitudes that focus on risk avoidance. Continued messaging is essential to allow youth to make healthy choices. So the dip that we saw between post and follow-up, we really think that keeping the message going, keeping the program going year after year should help take care of that dip. So that little loss in knowledge and loss in attitudes basically says that kids need to hear this message again and again, year after year, just so that they don't lose all of that information. Also, programs should focus on countering perceived norms with facts. So if kids think everybody is doing it and telling them, well, you know, everybody's not doing it, could help. Also, teens should avoid all risk behaviors like smoking, drinking, drugs, and of course, sex. And we need to promote skills that help these kids deal with peer pressure. So choosing the right friends, choosing the right peer group is really, really important, because kids are going to do what their friends are doing. And also, parent-teen communication and monitoring. Parents need to stay involved. They need to talk to their kids. They need to monitor what their kids are doing, who they're talking to, where they're going, when they're going, and stuff like that. Our study does have some limitations. These are self-reported data, so you know, there's always the chance that there could be a social desirability bias, so kids may be answering questions based on what they think their educators want to know. But we're hoping that telling them again and again that these are anonymous surveys, we don't know what you're saying, could take care of that a little feeling that kids have. We do need longer follow-up to see what happens if this program is continued year after year, and we're getting some of that data. We also need to keep in mind that there are certain cultural beliefs, especially in these communities, that may influence some of the things that are happening. For example, these are communities where teens have seen their mothers, their sisters getting pregnant at an early age. So for them, that's a natural consequence of being at that age. A lot of them don't have a future in mind, a future of going to college. So for them, it's okay to get pregnant when you're 15, and that's fine. So no matter how much you tell them about the consequences of teen pregnancy, they may not really feel it's that important. Also, there's a lot of local factors influencing the behaviors in these kids. There's a lot of border violence going on in that area. And so there's a lot of kids that are coming in from across the border. They've seen a lot of violent situations, and just being under that stress of constant violence around them makes them engage in risky behaviors a little bit more, because they feel like, how can I plan for college or 5 years in advance when I don't know if I'm going to be alive tomorrow, so let me just do everything today. Also, we need to look at other factors that may influence sexual activity. I feel we know a lot less than we should know. And some of that can be done by collecting qualitative data, asking the kids how they do things or why they do things, rather than just collecting survey information. So there's definitely a need for more qualitative data. In conclusion, our program has shown some significant changes in knowledge and attitudes of high school-aged youth, Hispanic youth, and the favorable changes were mostly retained even after the school year ended. And other risk behaviors, peer influences, and attitude toward abstinence and parental connectedness are factors that can delay sexual activity in high school age youth. Just a disclaimer, this study was funded by a grant from the Administration for Children and Families. Its contents are solely the responsibility of the authors and do not necessarily represent the official views of the ACF, the DHHS, or the US government. So it's all my fault. And there's my contact information if you need to contact me. I'd be happy to provide you with details if you email me or call me if you want to know the details.
Thank you. So we'll take some questions from this presenter first, and then open it up again to other presenters for maybe themes that you might have noticed among the four presentations.
Yes, ma'am.
What was the opt-in rate?
What was the... We actually have really good opt-in rates. The lowest we've ever gone is 75%, but most of the grades, it's more than 90%. Mm-hmm. Yes, sir?
Thank you for that very informative presentation. I'm wondering if you also collected the information or if you assessed other forms of connectedness or thought about doing that, for example, connectedness to community or school, or non-parental adults, those have also been shown to be protected against mental disability.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know now connectedness is looked upon as a broader thing, not just parent connectedness. Unfortunately, we've only looked at parent connectedness for two reasons. One is because we have a parent component to the program, so that helps us, look at both those data together. And secondly, our surveys are really, really long. They have 100 items or 100 questions in them, or more than that, actually. So we already hear from the kids that they really hate seeing those surveys because they're so long. So, unfortunately, we haven't asked any other connectedness questions. Yes, sir?
Yes, ma'am.
The school districts. We've actually had really good support from the school districts and from the communities themselves, and some of it is because of our program administrator, who's a really, really dynamic lady. She's been working in those areas for at least 8 years now, and she had these relationships. She knows the school administrators, she knows the school nurses and counselors, she's done classes for the parents and grandparents in those areas. So when she was doing the parent classes, they wanted something like this for the kids. We went in and talked to the administrators. We got approvals from the school boards. We showed them the curricula and the classes that we were planning to do, what kind of information we were going to cover. So And they felt that there was a need for the kids to know all of this information. So they've been really supportive. And over the years, as the program has gone on, they've seen the results of the program. They've seen what kind of effect it has on the students and the community. And actually, the schools have reported pregnancy numbers to us, and their pregnancies are going down year after year, ever since we've gone into the school districts. So seeing those numbers go down has really helped them want to keep the program going. In fact, in one of the school districts, they provide a bus for pregnant teens, pregnant girls. And in the last year, they had to change from a big bus to a small van because their numbers had gone down so much. So that was, yeah, they've been supportive, very supportive so far. Yes, we do. We do talk about all contraceptive methods, condoms, birth control pills. I think we added something about emergency contraception as well, the shot, the patch, and everything. So we do provide that information on contraception. We provide effectiveness rates from the research. We do tell the kids that if they want information, they need to see a healthcare provider, because in these communities, a lot of kids are just going across the border, getting some pills from the pharmacies, and not using them as they're supposed to be used. Sometimes they're even sharing those with their friends. So we do really encourage them that if they're sexually active, they need to go to a healthcare provider, get screened and tested, and then get any contraceptive advice from a healthcare provider.
I was wondering if you looked at different, or talk about different levels of risky behavior in terms of having sex can be risky behavior. Having sex with no protection at all is really risky behavior. So I'm wondering whether you talk about that, or when you looked at the survey, whether you actually look at kind of what level of risky behavior are we talking about. Mm-hmm. And in the survey, did you ask about, because maybe you mentioned it, but I didn't see it, in terms of did they use protection? Did they know
right.
about it? You know, would they plan to, what their attitude is? It seems like it's really abstinence focused.
Mm-hmm.
And so many programs, it seems like these days, are showing that abstinence focus is not necessarily really
mm-hmm.
effective, and it's more about the, you know, understanding the risk and then being able to make an informed choice
mm-hmm.
with actually access to family planning.
Right. We do, I'm going to answer your questions one at a time. So yeah, we do ask about condom use and also use of contraceptives other than condoms when they're having sex. And we haven't seen any, in fact, these are pretty preliminary data from the first year of the program. So we've seen changes in knowledge and attitudes, and it's going to take some time for behaviors to change. And like I said, we do provide information on contraceptives when we do tell them to go seek help from a healthcare provider rather than try to get information from their peers. So they have to know how to use, if they want to use contraceptives, how to use them, what's the correct way of using them, that they need to use them consistently. And they need to get that information not from their friends. And it is, yeah, it is an abstinence-based, it is an abstinence-based program. But we don't completely exclude information on contraception. And one of the reasons it's abstinence-based is because that's what the community wants. The parents, in fact, when we had not specified that this was an abstinence-based program, we actually had a harder time getting consents from parents than after we told them this is an abstinence-based, look at the curriculum, this is what we're talking about. And in our parent component, we do tell the parents to talk to their kids and form their own message. If they want to tell their kid to that they should not have sex when they're in school, then that's what they should tell them. If they make up their mind and say, hey, it's okay for you to go ahead and have sex, but just use a condom, but that's what they tell them. So we leave it up to the parent to tell them what they feel is in line with their values and what they want their kids to know. So that's...
Are there questions for the other panelists? Or, well, okay, go ahead. Yes.
Go ahead. Yeah, one of the things we do, and again, this is a little bit more relevant to our parent program, but I guess it's all mixed in. One of the things we do is when the parents finish their parent curriculum classes, we have a graduation event. So it's one way that we motivate them to keep coming back for the different curriculum sessions. And it's also an event to celebrate their graduation from the parent curriculum. And during this event, it's a dinner, a sit-down dinner, where they also talk to our peer mentors. We have some peer mentors from in our program who provide a couple of sessions to the students, and they also talk to their parents and help answer some questions that the parents may have, like, you know, parents ask about all sorts of things, like, why is my kid doing this? Is my kid doing this? How can I talk to my kid about, you know, certain things? So the peer mentors sort of form a bridge between the parent and the youth. So the parent doesn't have to ask their kid, how am I supposed to talk to you about this? But they're asking someone closer to their kid's age and saying, I don't understand my kid. I don't know why they're doing this. What do I do? So it's through peer mentors, and they do get a chance to talk to the peer mentors.
I just had a question for all four of you.
Oh, go for it.
Did any of these have financial incentives for people to participate in programs and services?
We, the survey company we work with, they provide points that panelists accumulate for taking surveys, and then they can kind of cash those in for gift certificates at the end. So they basically got $5 each worth of points.
Our program has a professional development component to it, and the young people that participate get somewhere between $200 and $500 over the period of about a year and a half to actually work on their own professional development, where they can take courses or participate in other activities that they feel like are a part of their personal development. But it's not something that's really talked about in the recruitment process of it.
And so when the youth are coming together for the fellowship, so is there transportation or anything?
Yeah, we cover all costs. It's a fellowship program, so it's fully sponsored for them. They don't have to put any of their own costs, just a lot of their own time.
So the National Survey of Children's Health is funded by CDC, so.
Yeah, and we don't provide any incentives for our surveys. For the parents, the only incentive is that they get to come to the graduation dinner. And for the students, I think we've provided pens during one school year, but otherwise it's just that they're helping us out.
Other questions, Tom? Okay, great job.